I'd like now to welcome to the program Erin Kamler. She is a scholar and author and doctoral student at the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. And this Friday, she will be talking about the trafficking of women in Thailand. That's at the Santa Fe Women's Club at 5:30, presented by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on.
So how did you come to study human trafficking in Thailand?
Well, I've been actually traveling to Thailand over the past 3 years. And initially, I was actually a student in Thailand, an exchange student when I was in high school back in those days. And so learned the language and learned a lot about the culture and really fell in love with the country and decided later to come back to school and explore this issue that actually has a lot of just a lot of meaning for me and interest for me, given my work as a feminist writer and scholar.
And so this is an issue, human trafficking, trafficking of women in particular. I mean, it's an issue of migrant labor. Who are these women who are trafficked? Where do they come from? Why do they leave home?
Well, it's a complex issue, and I think one of the things that many people don't quite understand until they take a deeper look is that trafficking does not necessarily happen the way that the U.S. government and other bodies perceive it. So we have this sort of myth, particularly in the West, that all women who are sex workers, for example, are trafficking victims. And this is actually also the stance of the U.S. government. And this is something I really critique in my work, because over the last few years, I've interviewed many, many migrant laborers and sex workers on the ground in Thailand, and have discovered that actually the differences and discrepancies between real human trafficking and labor migration are actually very vast. Many women travel from Burma, Cambodia, Laos, these countries that surround Thailand, into Thailand in search of work. Because of their precarious status as laborers, sometimes they also don't have passports, you know, they don't have the proper documents. Because of the status, they're often either exploited in positions, such as domestic labor or factory labor or positions of sex work. But the point is that they come in search of work. So this notion that a lot of research on trafficking, or a lot of researchers have sort of presented, that women are duped into, you know, traveling, women are sort of tricked into crossing the border, is really a misnomer. And that's a lot of the critique that I address. That's an issue that I address in my work, that actually women have quite a bit of agency in their migration processes. It's just an issue of their exploitation once they go to the destination country that's the problem.
Well, and as you write in some of your papers, that once they're there and they're doing sex work or prostitution or whatever you want to call it, their objection isn't necessarily to doing the work, it's the conditions under which they're doing the work, and those are the changes that they want.
That's exactly right. Often women report that the sex work in particular is not the problem. It's the issue of the difficult migration process and the lack of protections under that process that they really are concerned with. The other problem is that within the situations of sex work and prostitution, because it's illegal in Thailand, just as it is in the United States, there's very few opportunities to unionize or to regulate the work or the workplace environment. And a lot of women really argue that if they had better protections in these environments, you know, in brothels and karaoke bars and massage parlors, places where sex work takes place, that they could actually protect themselves and have more power and have more ability to have agency in those jobs. But because of the nature of the because it's criminalized, you know, the nature of the precarious labor situation, women are often exploited in those positions. So it becomes this vicious cycle that ends up really hurting the women rather than helping to empower them. And in addition, several of the policies that are enacted by the State Department to try to prevent trafficking end up hurting the women who actually are there by choice, rather than helping the victims who these policies are intended to protect. So it's a very complex issue that really demands a much more nuanced research approach if we're ever to make headway in this area.
Well, one of the things that you write about is that the United States State Department is involved in anti-trafficking efforts, and they're leading these so-called smart raids. What are these smart raids?
So smart raids are a policy that the U.S. government, the State Department, has come up with in collaboration with non-governmental organizations on the ground in Thailand and elsewhere in the world to essentially raid bars and try to rescue victims of human trafficking. The policy is very well intended. The whole objective is to find victims of human trafficking who are often basically located because they're underage. Basically, any sex worker under the age of 18 is automatically considered a victim. And essentially what happens is that these NGOs and the government raid the bars and raid the brothels, and they round up all the women, and they try to identify victims of human trafficking. Well, the problem in Thailand is that this takes a long time, and it's a weeding out process. And what happens is women are detained in these international detention centers, often without due process and often without proper translators being present. So what happens is that the women who are there by choice end up losing, you know, time, they lose wages, they essentially lose the ability to send money home to their families, which in turn affects whole communities on the ground in these other countries. So it's a very detrimental policy, even though, of course, it's well-intended. The way it's enacted is a real problem.
And they're also essentially in prison.
Yeah, I mean, if you're being held for a period of, you know, sometimes up to months, or sometimes some research has indicated that some women have been held for over a year, you have no mobility. They often don't have the access to communication technology. And this is because of another issue, which is that often these women are, again, precarious migrants who are there illegally, essentially. So you also have this conflated with all of this is Thailand's immigration policy, which is very strident and very strict about keeping people out who are not, you know, there legally. So you have people being detained partly because of their labor as sex workers, partly because of their immigration status, and it ultimately really hurts the women who the policy is trying to help.
We're talking to Erin Kamler about the trafficking of women in Thailand. Now, there are women who are women and girls who are underage, they are young, and there are some who are there against their will. What has your research turned up about them and their lives?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, trafficking is a real problem, and it's a real issue. And this is another thing that sort of complicates the whole space and the research on the space. Thailand's response, based on the State Department's anti-trafficking policies, is to try to bolster prosecutions. This is how Thailand essentially increases its status in what's called the Trafficking in Persons Report. This is a report that the State Department issues every year, which kind of identifies or tries to sort of outline what every country in the world is doing to stop trafficking. Well, the way that they monitor this is to sort of see how many prosecutions each country has, and that's one of the sort of benchmarks for a country's, you know, whether a country's complying with the State Department's standards. The problem in Thailand is that really there have only been a few prosecutions. I was doing research in 2011, and one very prominent NGO employee told me that they'd only had four prosecutions that year. So the issue then becomes, you know, the issue then is a question of whether these NGOs are actually identifying trafficking victims or whether they're missing them. One of the problems I see with this focus on sex trafficking and these brothel raids, these smart raids, is that often they're looking in the wrong places. You have, their research has shown that often there's domestic labor where, you know, really exploitive conditions happen for women. Factory labor is also a real problem. But these are areas where the NGOs don't really go. It's harder to access those people. But because sex trafficking is such a, for lack of a better term, sexy area.
Right.
You know, often you see the policies focused on sex work establishments where not necessarily as much exploitation is actually occurring. So the point here is that there are victims of human trafficking. These policies should really be designed to reach them, but often they're not reaching the people who they're intended to help.
I mean, it really sounds for all the world like drug trafficking, where you've got gigantic organized crime networks, and then you've got cops going after the smallest players. And
yeah, no, that's not, it's a very good parallel. I mean, and you see, you know, there've been reports of factory labor, for example, being a real problem. But of course, because of sort of the neoliberal, you know, investment in large companies wanting to either hire people for very low wages in the developing world, places such as Thailand, or even worse, for slave wages. There aren't as many crackdowns on those establishments, and there's not a real solid policy in place to protect victims in those situations.
And meanwhile, if some women are taken into custody, and even one small ring is broken down, the supply will still be there because there will always be somebody to fill whatever the demand is, whether it be for prostitution or whatever.
Right. I mean, there is this demand concern. There's this sort of supply and demand argument in the anti-trafficking world that, well, if you just reduce demand, you know, teach men to be better men, or, you know, by not wanting to be with sex workers, this kind of thing. One of the problems with anti-trafficking policy is it's enacted by the State Department is it really relies on these Western moralisms around sex and around morality that I think are really missing the point. The point here is that many countries are in situations where women are taking up the burden of having to support families and communities. Burma, for example, is a country still second to the bottom, you know, in terms of its poverty, in terms of political dysfunction, even though the conditions, we hear reports that the conditions on the ground are getting better. My research shows that in many cases they really aren't. And the Burmese government really hasn't changed things for the people in ways that are helping them lead functional lives. For example, there's still ethnic warfare occurring in Burma, and many of the women I've talked to are from these ethnic minority communities. Well, they migrate into Thailand because they have very little options for making money. They have very little options for living a decent life, and they have very little safety. So migration is a real issue that has changed since globalization, since the advent of globalization. And it's something that we need to look at when we develop policy to address these issues, because they don't happen in a vacuum. For example, you can't just say, well, if we reduce demand for sex work, there won't be any sex trafficking. You know, there will always be migration, and we have to really examine those processes rather than try to sort of impose a moralistic stance on the issue.
It seems like yet another one of those examples where really well-intentioned workers, whether they be in the State Department or non-governmental organizations or whatever, go in, look at a problem, and put their stamp of what should be done on it and make big policies and try to do it. And they never really listen to the women themselves and ask them what they want, which you have done. What do the women say that they want?
Again, you know, the women on the ground are really smart people, and that's because they're experts in their own lives. You know, they understand what they're doing. They understand that they're taking big risks when they migrate across the border. Often they're unable to get the proper documents because of, as I said, you know, political issues and economic issues. But they want essentially a better life for themselves and for their families and communities. To do that, they need safe migration. They need their process of crossing the border and of working in another country to be supported by the government and also by non-governmental organizations. Trafficking is one little tiny piece of the puzzle here. So for all these organizations, well-funded organizations, to be so intent on stopping trafficking without looking at these broader circumstances and exactly without listening to the women's needs as they express them themselves, really misses the boat. And, you know, large, copious amounts of money are being spent on this movement without really doing enough research on what the women themselves want and what policies they think could help them.
It's so interesting. You're in a probably pretty unusual position as being an American woman who speaks the language. You were an exchange student there and actually has an ability to go in and talk to people and get them to answer honestly, which is probably not easy for most people who are there with a translator and credentials and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've sort of straddled the middle ground because I do speak Thai, so I do have a certain amount of access to, for example, Thai NGOs or members of government who are Thai. I don't speak the languages of the migrant women often unless they speak English, so I have had to work with translators. But it's a fine line to walk because Thailand is, I mean, I consider it like my second home, you know, and here I am being very critical of the government. But it's because I want the policies to be better, and I want people to listen to the women on the ground. But it's a really fascinating place to do work and a really amazing research subject and an opportunity for me.
We're talking to Erin Kamler about the subject of human trafficking or the trafficking of women in Thailand. Now, there are non-government and community-based organizations in Thailand that are addressing this issue that are Thai. What are they doing?
Well, often the Thai organizations are working with the Thai government and with the U.S. State Department. I've encountered very few community-based Thai organizations. Often the community-based organizations are run by migrant women themselves. So, for example, women from Burma, women from Laos, you know, people on the ground from these ethnic minority communities who have banded together essentially to try to address this issue really without the support of the government and without much funding at all. These are the organizations that I see doing the best work on the issue because they are made up of the migrant women themselves. So again, it's that question of, you know, who do we listen to in policy? Well, if we listen to the people on the ground who are going through this and are experiencing these problems and these issues in their daily lives, we'll probably be able to develop better policy. But Thailand and the Thai organizations themselves are kind of caught in the middle because many of them are funded and supported by the U.S. State Department. I think it's important to point out that this whole anti-trafficking movement is really driven by the State Department. That's where the funding is coming from. That's where the support is coming from. So to be part of that movement really means adhering to those policies and, again, sort of cultural and moralistic ideas that are completely being driven by the West.
Right. Very interesting. Now, you talk in your work about the relative merits of prevention versus raids on these establishments where trafficked people are working. What does prevention look like?
Well, prevention is something that's done, again, a lot by these community-based organizations who know the needs of the women and are trying to exactly prevent exploitation from occurring rather than just kind of dealing with this end result of rescue. So prevention looks like education policies, safe migration policies, you know, anything that can empower a woman on her journey essentially will prevent her exploitation. Again, it's not sexy. It doesn't have that sort of, you know, excitement of let's bust down a brothel door and save all these poor women. What it does, though, is it empowers women as they cross borders. So, for example, you have community-based organizations on the border in between Thailand and Burma who are literally working across the border with their communities in Burma to help educate women about how they can cross safely and what kind of labor they can find, what kind of jobs they can find in Thailand that won't exploit them, or if they are exploited, who they can call and where they can go. A lot of the time, these women, again, because of their status, you know, they don't have the right passport, they don't have the right papers, can't really seek help in Thailand, certainly not from the government or the police. Which is where you see these community-based organizations coming in to help them to prevent their exploitation.
It sounds like immigration issues are the same everywhere.
You know, it's a problem that it has such a direct mirror to what's going on in the U.S. that sometimes
yeah.
It's kind of staggering. And again, this is this is that larger conversation about globalization and about really the feminization of migration. Women are tasked all over the world with being the breadwinners, essentially, through their migration, through their movement to try to find work for their to support their families and communities. And this is the larger issue that I think we need to be looking at, as a global community, to prevent problems from happening, to prevent these cross-border dysfunctional problems from happening. But yes, it certainly is the same in many regions of the world.
One of the things I'm getting from your work is that it's less fruitful to talk about victims and perpetrators than it is to talk about differences in economic status and power status, but everybody's doing what they need to do given where they are in their lives at that moment, and to understand those things through a different lens than the victim-perpetrator lens would be fruitful.
Exactly. I mean, again, one of my critiques of this anti-trafficking movement as the U.S. government kind of imagines it and enacts it is that it really renders a lot of women sort of powerless. I mean, if you're calling women victims because of the circumstances of their migration or the circumstances of their labor, you're really doing them a disservice, because then as soon as they're labeled a victim, people aren't listening to them. You know, people aren't taking them seriously. People aren't using them as experts, or not using them, but, you know, treating them as experts in their own lives. So these policies really disable women's agency. You know, women are sort of either treated as victims of human trafficking, or if they've consented to prostitution, often they're considered criminals. And you have this sort of binary categorization that, as a feminist scholar, it smacks of a real, real disempowering sort of disservice to women the world over.
Erin Kamler is a scholar and author. She's a doctoral student at the USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and she will be talking about the trafficking of women in Thailand this Friday at February 15th at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Women's Club on Old Pecos Trail here in Santa Fe, presented by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Catherine Ugaretz. She is the manager of the Gutsy Girls program at the Santa Fe Institute, and we are here to talk about the 34th annual Expanding Your Horizons Math and Science Conference. We are joined by students Sarah Hartze and Celeste Hernandez. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what is this Expanding Your Horizons conference all about? It's happening on March 2nd at the Santa Fe Convention Center.
Yes, thank you. The Expanding Your Horizons conference is a STEM conference, so it covers science, technology, engineering, and math, as well as computer science. And it's for girls, 5th grade through 12th grade. And what the girls do is they come to the conference, they take different workshops with scientists. This year we have an amazing group of women scientists, many from LANL as well as other communities, coming to give hands-on workshops for girls who are interested.
And so this is really about getting more women into scientific careers in the long run.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, the two of you, what is your interest in this? Have you done this kind of conference in past years?
Well, I've been involved in Project Guts and Gutsy Girls for about 5 years, first as a student and then as a mentor. And I worked at UIH last year as a presenter, and I'm doing that again this year.
Now, let's talk about Guts for a second. What does Guts stand for?
Guts stands for Growing Up Thinking Scientifically, and it is an after-school program that was started by the Santa Fe Institute for middle school age students to try and raise interest in computer science and technology.
And so you got involved with that. What was your particular interest?
I wasn't really sure what I was interested in when I was in seventh grade, but it was fun, and I did it for 2 years, and I liked programming after I did it.
What about you, Celeste?
Well, I started Gutsy Girls last year. This is my second year in the program, coming in as a mentor. And I went to Expanding Your Horizons last year as well with my school. I really wasn't sure what I wanted to go in for. My teacher kind of encouraged me to go into it, and I really love the technology part of STEM.
So what kind of, like, are you also a programmer a little bit?
Kind of. I mean, I'm not really good at it. I try my best, but yeah, it's really fun. So.
Let's talk for a moment about girls and young women in the sciences these days. I mean, there have been so many studies done, and I remember when I was in college reading about all the different ways in which parents and teachers, consciously or unconsciously, were favoring boys and that gave them more confidence and things like that. Where are we now?
Well, I think where we are now is looking at many years of data and trying to, and the kind of data that you're talking about, where people, even with very, very good intentions, may have implicit biases. So, for instance, my brother used to complain in math class how the teacher, when my brother had a problem, would come over to him and say, well, you can, you know, do this, figure it out. And a girl next to him might have the same problem, and the teacher would come and say, oh, well, let me do this for you.
Ah.
And what happens in those scenarios is that, although in the case of my brother, he thought the girl was getting special treatment, it doesn't empower that girl or that young woman to realize, you know, math is not necessarily a natural ability. It can be something learned and something that you get you through grit and just going through the mistakes and the difficulties and having someone support you while you do that.
Right.
So I think that we're looking a lot at how different learning environments really empower and support girls in thinking that you don't have to be a natural to get good at something. If you're curious, if you love technology, and you're in an environment that's supportive and fun and hands-on, you'll start to pick things up and you'll realize things about yourself that maybe you didn't realize.
Celeste is nodding in agreement. Is that right? Is
yes.
that your experience?
Yes, it has been my experience. Because, like, in many classes I've had, when guys don't get something, the teachers will explain to them and let them work on it again. But when it comes to helping out the girls, instead of actually helping them out, they do the work for them. And it kind of makes the girls feel like they don't think I can do this. They have to do the work for me.
So that's still going on.
Yes.
Prejudice dies slowly.
Well, it's tricky when people are trying to be helpful. And it's tricky when sometimes we're not even aware. And Harvard put out this implicit bias test that a person can take online. I took it at a seminar myself. It's really interesting. And it's not to make anyone feel bad. It's just to make us more conscious and aware. Am I doing something for this person because I am trying to help them, or should I really focus on supporting them and developing their abilities? And it just is, I think a lot of it is not mean-spirited bias. It's just busy people and not being able to notice those things or be conscious of them.
What about you, Sarah? Have you encountered that kind of gender difference yourself?
Yeah, like, it's not something that people are consciously doing. I can tell, like, most people I work with are trying to be really supportive. But it's just the fact that being a girl in a lot of science, technology areas, I'm an exception, and Celeste is an exception, and you're treated differently to some extent. Like, people, they definitely try to avoid doing that, but it's something that that just happens. And that's the great thing about Gutsy Girls, is because you're surrounded by a bunch of other girls and you aren't sticking out, and you can, it's I think a more comfortable situation, and I think it helps people be more confident about their abilities and not feeling strange that they're out of place.
I think it's such an interesting and important thing to think about, is the relationship between ability and confidence. You gather the confidence and you can do what you want to do. You lack the confidence, and no matter how good you are innately, whatever innately even means, there's too much in your way.
Yeah.
That's very true. And a lot of the studies show something interesting. Celeste and I were talking about it earlier, again, talking about math, where a male student might get a B minus, let's say, in an advanced math class, and a female student may get the exact same grade, the B minus. But what those two students may make that mean about themselves can be very different. The male student doesn't assess that B- as saying anything about his ability in math necessarily. He just keeps moving along. Whereas a female student may interpret that B- as, I'm not good at math, I don't really belong here, which is trickier, you know, for women and other underrepresented groups if they already feel like they have to be exceptional to be a part, to have a place at the table, educationally speaking. And one of the things that I love about the Expanding Your Horizons Conference and these other programs for girls is that the young women and the girls have the opportunity to be in an environment where they're surrounded by female scientists, by other girls who are curious and they care and they're interested in chemistry or computer science or engineering, and they're able to just sort of play and relax. And just having that experience, I think, is really important. Even if it's a one-day conference, it can have a lifetime impact and discovering what you want to do.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's obviously maybe too early for you girls who are in, well, high school and middle school right now, but do you have kind of a sense of direction at this point?
Not a huge sense of direction, but I know I definitely want to study computer science and possibly physics and math. I'm not entirely sure what I want to do with it, but I know it's something I enjoy. And building on what Catherine said, just having a kind of community evolve from these programs, I think, can make a huge difference in maybe not so much giving girls direction in what they want to do, but letting them know that there are options. And that's what Expanding Your Horizons refers to. Looking out and being able to say, okay, look at all these incredible careers, and these are all something that I can do.
Yeah.
Same here. I'm not sure what I want to do when I get older, but I do want to study computer science because it's really fun and it's something I want to do when I get older. I do want to be in the FBI because it seems like a really good job, and yeah. And Gutsy Girls is really giving me that push and that, like, they let me know I have people who I can always count on to, like, give me that push, who will always be there when I have, like, my bad days and good days. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's a really big part of it, too, is being not only knowing you can do it, but being supported when you're having trouble doing it.
Absolutely. And one of the things, too, that you know, we've learned through research is that girls oftentimes will try to avoid mistakes, especially smart girls feel that a mistake or a failure might mean something more than it means, and want to avoid that. So, for instance, they might do something less challenging to avoid the possibility of mistakes and failure, which is actually not what you want to be doing in the sciences or in anything, I think one would argue.
Yeah.
Mistakes are our friends, and our failures are some of our best, although certainly sometimes unpleasant, teachers. And the confidence that I see in these young women, especially our mentors that work with our program, I love watching how they reach out to the younger girls and support them and provide this sort of like an inspiration where you can be someone who cares about school, who cares about science, who cares about technology, and still have a really good time and be social and do things as a team. And in terms of the workforce, having that kind of teamwork is going to be really essential. And there are going to be so many jobs when these girls are graduating from college and that don't exist yet. So it's really about those sort of abilities that you're developing right now, and you don't necessarily know what you are. You don't need to know what you're going to do, but if you know what you love, you can start there.
Yeah, exactly. Now, both of you mentioned being mentors.
Yes.
What? Tell us about that. Like, how does that work in the Gutsy Girls program?
Basically, we help out with the workshops that involves basic setup and then organizing the project and what we're working on. And then also, when the day of the workshop comes, working with a group of girls and kind of connecting with those girls and making sure everything's going all right with them and helping them with the project and just kind of talking with them.
And so have you, like, in your role as mentor, do you then keep in touch with some of those girls later?
Well, this is my first year, but last year I still kept in touch with one of my mentors, who's a mentor this year. She's really nice, and I know she's always there for me when I'm having, like, bad times, and I know I can count on her for anything. And mentors, I think, play a big part in this because we encourage the girls to step outside their box, and we make them feel like they're in a safe environment where they can just be themselves.
Also, another way of keeping in touch with girls is Gutsy Girls. We have our own personal social network, which is basically a Facebook-type program that all the girls have. It's a closed network, but all the girls have accounts on it, and so that's a way of just kind of keeping in touch and sharing information and chatting and things like that. So that helps a lot.
We're talking about the Gutsy Girls program. GUTS stands for Growing Up Thinking Scientifically, and that's based at the Santa Fe Institute. Now, Catherine Ugaretz, you're at the Santa Fe Institute and presumably have done a lot of observing of this whole subject. What's it like right now for women in the sciences, for example, in university departments?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I'm the right person to answer that question, frankly. But what I tend to notice is that I think women are working incredibly hard and passionately about their projects and their research that they're very focused on. But I don't know if you saw the article in the Times about the two resumes that were sent to folks. And so I think we still have...
Tell us about that.
Well, I'm going from memory here, but as a test, they sent out two resumes, exactly the same qualifications on both of them, to various leaders in science and academia, and asked, you know, how much they would hire these people for.
And one was a man's
name. One was a man's
name,
and one was a woman's name. I think Jennifer, they gave her the name Jennifer. And the feedback that they got is that there was a difference in terms of how much they were willing to offer the person, how willing they were to take the person, and it was based on gender. The female candidate was being offered less money, and fewer opportunities. So, and I think that it's, once again, it goes back a little bit to that implicit bias that folks may have. And I think the best way to work around that is to keep working and have more and more women in the field.
Yeah.
And that's...
Until women start being the ones who are doing the hiring.
Yeah. And women have to be careful of their own implicit biases as well.
Yeah.
But certainly, I think that's really important, where people feel that they are welcome and comfortable. So, I mean, I know that women certainly, it's a tricky balance, but they are doing some amazing work. And I think that in the next 10 or 20 years, which is frankly not fast enough for me, but I'm learning to just sort of go with the flow that way, we'll hopefully see some changes.
I mean, I think we've already seen a lot of changes because there are more rules and there's just more awareness than there was, at least when I was in high school and college. I mean, sexual harassment was the norm when I was in college and there were no rules against it. The things that professors said to the female students are unbelievable. They'd get fired now.
Oh, absolutely. But one interesting piece of data that I think is sort of troubling is that the percentage of computer science undergraduate degree recipients who are women is actually going down.
Really?
Yeah. So it was higher, and I just updated this yesterday. But so in 1985, 37% of computer science undergraduate degree recipients were women. Now, in 2012, we have 14%.
Good heavens.
So why? You know, and I don't have an answer to what that is necessarily about. But there's something about how people are perceiving themselves or what they're thinking that career would be like or the environment of that career. I'm not sure. But I know we're working very, very hard to have young women really look seriously at the area of computer science as well as some of the other sciences as well, engineering. There's a lot of effort there to bring women in and to consider those possibilities.
I think it would be so important to have women be 50% of the engineers in this country.
Absolutely. And here's when I think of how much of our lives are framed by technology.
I know.
Right? So do we want only a very small percentage of people, both, you know, looking at gender and also looking at, you know, what community someone comes from. I think we want the most diverse group of people possible developing the kind of things that are going to be shaping our world.
I think it's important to try to understand and really do research studies about why, for example, talented women like you two girls choose the fields they do and choose, you know, to reject the fields that they don't want to end up going into. I read somewhere, and I don't have a footnote for this, but there was somebody actually studied why more women weren't going into engineering departments at a university, and it turned out that the guys liked the cubicles, but the women's liked the tables where they were sitting together and actually communicating with each other. And something as simple as putting tables in the room where you could talk to each other made a difference in what people majored in.
But that's huge, because that's the learning environment. And I would speculate that having a mixed environment where, say, you have the community tables as well as places you can retreat to do private work is also going to have a huge impact on what kind of things people are producing. How they're interacting, how problems get solved more quickly. A lot of businesses now are really looking at how they're creating space. So people are forced to interact with each other, problem solve more early, and those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's the idea of a scientist alone in a lab versus a group of people working together to try and solve a problem. And I think Catherine's right. It's not about a genius or a visionary entirely anymore. Like, that's what's publicized, or those are the stories you hear about. But in reality, it's people working together, and you get more creative ideas and you get more creative input. The more different type of people you can put together, the more women and minorities and just people from all over that you can get together, the more diverse problem solving you can achieve. And I think that's something that we definitely need to strive for, especially in technology, as Catherine said, because it's so important to everything we do in life.
Absolutely.
You know, one thing I wanted to point out, though, when just focusing again on the EYH conference, is that we have so much support from the community for these sorts of things. And so I think that one of the things we're seeing is that businesses and community members are realizing how essential it is to support really every student in the STEM fields, because it's so critical for success in the future for our country.
Now, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But anyway, you know, we're having great support, not just from the Santa Fe Institute and Gutsy Girls, but New Mexico Network for Women in Science and Engineering, LANL, the LANL Foundation, companies such as Flow Science and Rentech, Los Alamos National Bank, Whole Foods, Sandia National Laboratories, Mexico Export. I'm reading the list. I got to get this in. First National Bank. And really, the city of Santa Fe, they are donating the convention center. And that was with sponsorship from Councillor Wurzberger. So we are so fortunate here that despite some of the struggles that we have, that I think a lot of people's eyes are really open, that it's going to take a coordinated effort to make some change.
Thank you, City of Santa Fe, and everybody else who's participating in this. It's fantastic. And I think that there are so many gender stereotypes about, I mean, math and science being masculine ways of thinking, and poetry and art being feminine ways of thinking.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, it is nonsense.
Yes.
It is pure, total
nonsense.
Absolutely.
I think even the division between math and science and poetry and writing is kind of nonsense, because doing things like being human and creating things is about being able to be creative and being able to solve problems and think about things in a different way. And you need those skills in all of those fields. And it's something that shouldn't be divided by gender or anything else.
I mean, you do see guy poets, and you do see women teaching mathematics. It's not one way or another. So
yeah.
I think it goes both ways. I think sometimes women can be sexist towards what men can or can't do, and then men can be very sexist towards what women can and can't do.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I have to say it's very important for women to notice our own gender biases too when we have them.
Definitely.
Whether it be putting down men for something which we shouldn't be putting them down for, or I noticed the other day I went into Radio Shack and there was a male and a female employee. And my first thing was, oh, I better ask the guy because I need some real specific technology thing. And I was like, no. And so I went to the woman. And of course, she knew everything because the women in Radio Shack are awesome.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, my God, I'm still carrying this around? But I caught myself and was happy that I caught myself.
Oh, absolutely. And I just to underscore something Sarah said earlier about creativity, I think she makes a really important point that sometimes people can have the assumption that if you're creative, you must be in one of the arts. But if you're in computer science or engineering or other areas, you need to be enormously creative if you're going to come up with a solution around how to make a better bridge or even something, you know, how to make a better shoe or a computer program that does something that no one imagined could be done 5 years ago. So I think if you are a creative person, I think we want to feel like everything is open to you, that it's not just one area that you need to be in.
Well, I think also something that you said, Sarah, is really important, because putting really strong boundary lines between the kind of creativity that you have in math versus poetry, there are, I'm sure, a lot of examples where people who have been reading poetry and looking at art use those metaphors or use what they learned there to come up with solutions in a completely different field, maybe a technical field. And so having a well-rounded education is also really important.
Yeah, definitely. My math teacher will wax poetical about math for a very long time. Like, he is one of the most poetical people I know in all of my classes, and he will talk about math as something that's creative, and it's about illuminating ideas, and it's about seeing connections, and that's what creativity is. And also this kind of ties in to the core message of the Sanff Institute, which is interdisciplinary scientific pursuits, looking at breaking down those boundary lines between sciences, because it's at those boundaries where interesting new things start to happen that people haven't looked at before.
So back to the Expanding Your Horizons Math and Science Conference for Girls. It's on March 2nd at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center. And people can find it online by just, I guess you can just do a search engine, Expanding Your Horizons Santa Fe. It's a workshops for students, girls in 5th to 12th grade. And it's on March 2nd. Now, there's an early registration deadline coming up.
Well, our early registration deadline is the 15th of February.
Oh, okay.
So this Friday.
It's coming right up, yeah.
It's coming right up. But go ahead and keep registering even after that. You can register online. And but also, if anyone doesn't have online access and needs a registration form, they can call me at the Institute. And that number is 946-2776, and I can find a way to get that to them. I've also reached out to schools with paper registration as well. We really want everyone who is interested to be there, and the registration fee is $5 just to help with lunch. But if that's
the cheapest conference in the history of the universe.
Well, that's what we want. We want it to be cheap. And here's the thing: if you can't pay that, we still want you there.
Okay.
There's a little box you can click and no questions asked. We want students there who are curious and interested and want to have a good time and learn.
Catherine Ugaritz is manager of the Gutsy Girls program at the Santa Fe Institute. Sarah Hartsey and Celeste Hernandez are students. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.